Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 29, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A UN aid agency welcomes a temporary ceasefire in Gaza and calls for the unfettered delivery of humanitarian aid.
What has to happen, I mean, very simply, James, is, you know, a ceasefire has to continue, and we need to have unfettered, unobstructed delivery of humanitarian aid.
Sudanese women describe their suffering since the war broke out in April. The Kenyan High Court strikes out key clauses of a contentious finance law blamed for rising taxes and the cost of living. Ugandan opposition in parliament defies the speaker and continues its boycott. Sierra Leone's main opposition condemns Sunday's attack, which the government calls a failed attempted coup.
We believe that the only way that you can ascend to power is through the ballot box and not by the barrels of the guns.
And the impact of gender-based violence on Ugandan female journalists. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United Nations Relief and Works Agency, also known as UNRWA, says it welcomes the temporary ceasefire between Israel and Hamas because it is helping to alleviate the suffering of the people of Gaza. Adam Poulloukos is the director of UNRWA Affairs in the West Bank. He says conditions for 1.1 million internally displaced in UNRWA facilities in Gaza are tragic. Poulloukos tells me that while the temporary ceasefire has made possible the delivery of some fuel, what the agency needs is the unfettered delivery of humanitarian aid, including fuel and flour.
The ceasefire is a welcome initiative, and we're very pleased about it because it's helping to alleviate the suffering of the people in Gaza. And we're estimating now, and it's hard to get the exact figures, but something like 1.8 million people have been displaced in Gaza since the start of the war. So the ceasefire, at a minimum, allows us to move around the Gaza Strip, particularly to the north. There is an Israeli kind of checkpoint north of Wadi Gaza that we have to kind of navigate our way through. But it gives us an opportunity to see the level of destruction, see the condition of our installations, and then to see how it is that we can best deliver services, food, water, medical supplies to those in the north. But the large number of people are in the south, where the needs are also absolutely enormous.
You said that ceasefire has allowed you to travel and see the level of destruction. How would you describe the overall humanitarian conditions in the area now that the ceasefire has allowed some delivery of trucks to enter Gaza?
Yeah, well, you know, I've been in this humanitarian business for almost 30 years, and the level of destruction that we're seeing in Gaza is unlike anything that many of us have, many humanitarian development professionals in UNRWA. Again, because it's such a small area, so densely populated, the bombardment has been massive. You know, the Israeli military is a very sophisticated, modern military that is, leveling Gaza, huge levels of destruction, which is why we've seen, you know, the 1.8 million people displaced. We have something like over 1 million internally displaced people, about 1.1 million internally displaced Gazans who are in our facilities in 156 shelters. Those are schools, health centers, other buildings. People are trying to seek refuge wherever they can. In these shelters, we've got something like, let's say, one toilet for about 150 people, one shower when there's water for about 700 people. Most people are wearing the same clothes that they had on the 7th of October. The limited fuel, limited flour and food and other foodstuffs is a huge challenge. So, you know, the conditions are absolutely tragic. And the number of people killed is also just enormous, many of whom are children. The injuries to people, the hospitals that don't have supplies, you know, doctors that are performing amputation procedures without any anesthetic. I mean, it's tragic. It's unlike anything that many of us have seen in our professional careers.
We've been reading that the temporary ceasefire has allowed delivery trucks to come into Gaza. What does this do now to the all-important fuel that your agency has talked about? Are you getting the fuel you need?
Yes, well, the primary needs now remain fuel and flour. Because the fuel is so important for running desalination plants, for our logistics operation of moving vehicles around the strip, loading and unloading, you know, all of the heavy equipment that's necessary. So fuel remains a continual challenge. Now, as I understand, fuel is coming in with some regularity. We've received something like more fuel in the last couple of days of the ceasefire than before, but the need is, you know, we're really kind of rationing fuel and being very careful with the fuel. What has to happen, I mean, very simply, James, is, you know, a ceasefire has to continue, and we need to have unfettered, unobstructed delivery of humanitarian aid.
Adam Boulukos is the director of Armed Affairs in the West Bank. Sierra Leone's main opposition All People's Congress, the APC party, has condemned what it calls any attempt to associate the party with any form of violence. In a statement released on Tuesday, the APC says it believes in coming to power through the ballot box, not through the barrel of the gun. This, as the government, for the first time, said on Tuesday that Sunday's attack on a military armory was a failed coup attempt. Sidi Yaya Tunis is the APC National Publicity Secretary. He tells me that the APC wants a speedy, fair, independent, and transparent investigation.
We outrightly condemn what happened on Sunday. It is unacceptable for a party that stands for democracy. We believe that the only way that you can ascend to power is through the ballot box, are not by the barrels of the guns. And so we are against any force that will attempt to destabilize this country politically, socially, or otherwise. Sunday, the security of the state came under threat. The peace and quiet of the people of this country was under threat. And so as a political party, we outrightly condemn the actions of those involved. And we call for speedy, open, fair, and inclusive investigation so that those responsible will face the full force of the law following due process.
So you are saying that the president or the government tried to tie your party to the event of Sunday?
Specifically, also on Sunday, we condemn outrightly. We have nothing absolutely to do with it, as stated in the press release put out by the secretariat. And we want to make that very clear. And so it is very concerning to us as a political party that anyone will attempt to link us or to link our party to events of November 26th, August 10th, and even September 11th.
The government is saying that this was an attempt to overthrow the government. That's what the Minister of Information said.
Yes, well, today I followed the press conference. The security sector made that clarification today for the first time officially, that indeed the events of the 26th of November was an attempted coup to overthrow the government of President Julius Maada Bio. But I'll say this, on the 26th night, the president made a very brilliant statement calling for unity, calling for calm, and calling on all political leaders, religious and traditional leaders, to join him, support him, so that we can get to the bottom of this. I think that statement was received very well by the nation, by political leaders. That is the way to go. And we believe that we must, as citizens of this country, especially leaders of political parties, we all must ensure that a thorough investigation is done so that those responsible can be brought to book. But at the same time, we are also concerned, as stated in the press conference, that people will attempt to point fingers at the APC, the attacks on our party office, because the Secretary General made it clear in the press conference that shots were fired at the party office. And also, we are made to understand through a press release from the office of the former president and images we saw also on social media that one of his assigned state bodyguard was shot.
Sidi Yaya Tunis is the National Publicity Secretary of the opposition All People's Congress Party of Sierra Leone. He was speaking with us from the capital, Freetown. The Kenyan High Court on Tuesday struck out key clauses of a contentious finance law that has been blamed for significantly raising taxes and the cost of living in East Africa's largest economy. Macharia Munene is a professor of history and international relations at United States International University in Kenya. He tells viewers Douglas Mpuga that the court's ruling is a blow to the government.
In Court of Appeal, the three judges said that the housing tax that had been imposed was unconstitutional, and therefore it kind of technically put derails the collection of tax in the name of housing. It is a blow to against the president and his drive for collecting money using the levy. The main thing is that the court said it was unconstitutional, null and void, and therefore cannot be enforced, which is a major blow. So yes, there was some happiness in some quarters, most of the people who are not happy about that levy. And of course, there is disappointment in some part of the high circle, unhappy about it.
This law had been backed by the IMF, and it's part of the government's efforts to increase revenue collection to pay for the ballooning foreign debt that the country has. What does this mean in political terms?
First of all, it is a blow to William Ruto, and also the fact that it's now clear, because government officials are saying openly that they are not in charge of the country. It's the IMF that's running the country, and the IMF is not always very popular with the public. The country is becoming poorer, partly because of the debt, but also because of mismanagement. And because of that mismanagement, there is a lot of unhappiness. And the selling of the levy had not been very good. The government did a poor job of explaining itself. And until that recently, Sanduku came admitting, no, you are forced by the IMF. It's not that what you want. Then you say, in that case, then who is in charge of the country? And it shows the weakness in the government. And if the government seems to be very weak, then it loses credibility and ability to do things. So it's very bad for the country.
Does the government have any legal recourse after this?
Well, I think they try to have a stay of execution. Well, they can appeal to the Supreme Court because it was the Court of Appeal. So if they appeal to the Supreme Court, if the Supreme Court finds differently, then that will be the recourse. If the Supreme Court does not overturn the Court of Appeal, then the whole thing, Ruto will have to be rethinking everything, and his advisors will need to become more innovative and bolder than they are, because right now they're just showing weakness, and the country can see it.
Macharia Munene is a professor of history and international relations at United States International University in Nairobi, Kenya. He spoke with viewers Douglas Mpuga. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 29. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Sudanese women of various backgrounds recently gathered in Nairobi to discuss the brutal war that has ravaged their country the past 7 months. With no end in sight, they feel their voices have been silenced. VOA Nairobi Bureau Chief Maria Madialo was there and has this report.
Women in Sudan were a big part of a revolution that helped end 3 decades of autocratic rule by former Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir. Their push for a transition to a civilian government was cut short when war broke out 7 months ago between the Sudanese army and the Rapid Support Forces paramilitary unit. Thousands are dead, millions are displaced, and there is no end in sight.
Since April 15, voices of civilians and voices of women has been completely, I would say, sabotaged. We didn't have a space to tell our story or to speak about our suffering.
Hala Al-Karib is with the Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa. She says her organization convened a two-day summit in Nairobi because it's important to bring Sudanese women and civil society groups together.
We have participants who came from conflict zone and they have endured living under fire and during and you know exposed to all kinds of violence for the past 7 months. It's really critical to listen to their stories, to listen to their experience, and to listen to their positions and views.
Some participants spent 3 to 10 days on the road to reach Nairobi, including Nidal Usman Musa, who runs the South Khartoum Kandakat grassroots organization.
We have faced much obstacles, displacement, refugees, rape, violence. We missed our job, our children, missed their education, and also we missed our voice in this war.
Alawiya Bahr el-Din, a former social worker, now a refugee in neighboring Chad, had to leave her home of El Janaina in West Darfur, where about 700 people were reportedly killed earlier this month after clashes between SAF and the RSF, according to the International Organization for Migration.
This is so difficult. The situation there is so difficult for women, believe me.
The fighting in Sudan has made it hard to reach certain areas, says Nadal Fadul, who's with SUDRO, the Sustainable Development Response Organization. She's based in the United States. Fadul says it's imperative the women unite toward peace and how to sustain it so the reality on the ground doesn't happen again.
So we're talking about people with diabetes, for example, not able to get insulin to treat their diabetes. We're talking about kids with malaria not able to get anti-malaria treatments. We're talking about women not able to get simple menstrual hygiene products to be able to go through that with dignity.
Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
In Uganda, it appears the boycott of parliament by opposition members is getting intense. The Speaker of Parliament told the boycotters to start attending parliamentary proceedings or be excluded from all the business of parliament, including sporting events outside the country. The opposition began their boycott last month to protest what they say is the government's failure to account for their supporters, who they alleged are being held by security forces. Matthias Mpuuga is the opposition leader in parliament. He tells me that what the speaker says is not rooted in Ugandan law.
As of now, we are still in boycott. And today morning, I addressed the country, re-emphasized and reiterated the continuation of our boycott. Today in the afternoon, in the plenary session, the House Speaker announced that government was ready tomorrow to come up with a statement responding to a plethora of demands that we made. And tomorrow early in the morning, we will convene with my team and the entire caucus of the opposition to figure out how to deal with a statement that will be made by government tomorrow in the afternoon. So apparently, as of now, the boycott is still on until otherwise announced.
Honorable, I read the speaker said that if you do not end your boycott, you will be barred from serving, I think, on committees or participating in some parliamentary issue involving, say, going to sports events abroad. What do you think about that?
I still think that this House Speaker made that statement in jest, probably to arouse further curiosity over the matter. Otherwise, the statement so made by the House Speaker has no space in our rules, let alone any law of the land. The circumstances under which such conditions can apply are different, and they have nothing to do with the prevailing condition. I think the Speaker was trying to be rather political than legal, and respond and respect legal matters, not political pronouncements.
One of your colleagues, or some of your colleagues, are saying that why don't you identify individuals that you think are missing so that the government can deal with that. But some of them say they don't know who you are talking about that is missing.
I think those individuals are really laggards in terms of information at their disposal. We have since profiled every missing person. We have provided information relating to family video graft, family members, children, parents, those who are married, wives speaking out to the nature of how their loved ones were abducted. So the information is readily available to whoever cares, and therefore the lack of information is no longer an issue. Each and every person has been properly profiled. The information was made available to the House Speaker. He conveyed it to the executive. The chapter of no information has since been closed.
The Honorable Matthias Mpuuga is the opposition leader in Uganda's parliament. He was speaking with us from Kampala. A Uganda media specialist says while the country has made some progress in addressing gender-based violence, women in the media have not fared that well. This as the world embarks on 16 days of activism against gender-based violence, which began November 25 and runs through December 10. Brenda Namanta is the Communications and Advocacy Officer of the Uganda Media Women's Association. She says when it comes to women in the media, gender-based violence manifests itself in the form of sexual harassment and body shaming, especially during this digital media era.
Actually, Uganda has made a bit of progress towards addressing the gender-based gaps in the country as far as discrimination and abuse of women and the other marginalized groups, particularly persons living with disability in the country. But we can't shy away from the fact that we still have loud and evident gaps, especially for women in media, whereby we see that one in three women have suffered gender-based violence, either in form of the physical, emotional, or sexual abuse. But this is very, very significantly worse for women in media, where we have one in two women continuously suffering all forms of gender-based abuse in the media in Uganda. So for me, on a scale of 1 to 5, whereas we have achieved 1, we are still as back as 4 in the challenges that women and persons with disability are facing in Uganda.
Brenda, when you say women in the media, how does the gender-based violence manifest itself when it comes to women in the media?
Yes, so for women in media, the strongest challenges come in forms of sexual harassment, which is a strong prevalence that we are having in the country. Recently, my institution, Uganda Media Men's Association, we did a research and we discovered that it is a silent, we call it a silent monster, that it is happening in most media houses in this country, but then even in the environment, in the public where female journalists are, they are sexually harassed by media management, colleagues, but even sources that they interact with. But away from that, a very salient issue is mental health, and that comes with the mental health abuse that female journalists are struggling with as another form of gender-based violence. Not to forget the digital migration that media is having, and therefore journalists have to also shift to the new trend. It is worse when it comes to the online space, that they are being body shamed, cyberbullied, that many have censored themselves in being actively present in the digital spaces. But then even physically, they are withdrawing increasingly. We see that we are having many females joining the media training institution and few joining into the newsroom. But even those few that join, it is difficult for them to sustain a 5 years profession as far as the media practice is concerned. Why? Because of the sexual harassment, the mental health abuse, and the cyberbullying increasingly becoming an issue amidst absence of supportive mechanisms in place like safety policies, a strong legal and regulatory framework in Uganda that would protect specifically on gender issues.
Brenda, so what do you think is being done in Uganda? How do you think people in Uganda should be sensitized about what you are saying?
The way to go for sensitization of the public about issues of GBV is to carry out campaigns that are media-centered, that we are having the online campaigns, but then also the mainstream campaigns that communicate what gender-based abuse is and the impact it can have on individuals, family units, communities, and the nation at large. After all, when women are marginalized out of contributing in decision-making processes or development processes, then we have half development at the end.
Brenda Namata is the Communications and Advocacy Officer of the Uganda Media Women's Association. She was speaking with us from Kampala. And that's it for this Wednesday, November 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing that you will have a lovely day.